Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Jason.
And today we have with us our good friend who's returning for the hat trick, I think, now at this point. And that would be C. Derek Varn of Pop the Left fame.
Yeah, Pop the Left, Mortal Science, from Alpha to Omega Reading Group. I do a lot of podcasting.
Emancipation
stuff.
Network?
Yeah, I'm involved in the Emancipation Network. I'm technically a founder of it, even though I wasn't on any of the podcasts that created it. So,
C. Derek Varn from the internet.
Yeah.
From the whole internet, the whole left internet.
Yeah.
I was going to say, and we're going to be talking about Bonapartism today.
Yeah.
Specifically, Bonapartism in the contemporary left.
Yeah, it's on my mind a lot. Partly because I'm rereading The Brumaire and being weirdly haunted by all of it. And partly because there's a degeneration towards a kind of socialist mythology that Bonapartism really kind of overlaps with. And I've also been thinking about, you know, there's been a lot of talk of the professional managerial class lately from left-wingers as opposed to its normal boosters, which are normally right-wingers. And trying to parse where that comes from, and a lot of the Bonapartism is ascribed to that, which is also fascinating. But so why would it be such a problem right now? I mean, like, you know, we don't have any Louis Napoleon. There's no concessions towards an autocratic figure. So why is it haunting us again? And what does it say about where a lot of these left movements are going to go when things get frustrated? And trust me, they've been sufficiently frustrated. Like, you know, for revolutionary pessimists, it's been hard to be pessimistic enough lately. Like,
reality is more pessimistic than we are at this point.
Yeah. Like I'm like, I still have some hope, but I, you know, and it's not just in the U.S. either. Like, this resurgence of neo-Maoism, the figure of Xi, the neo-Maoist defense of Putin, all this stuff tells me that, like, even in other countries, you're seeing something like a Bonapartist tendency on the left, which in some ways is, even to call it Bonapartist is like, it's always been with us even before there was a Bonaparte. Like LaSalle's degeneration into supporting the Bismarck, you know, the monarchy,
yeah,
is an example of this. So,
well, the old term was Caesarism, right?
Right. Yeah, socio-Caesarism.
Yeah.
Well, that reminds me of that Parenti book I read about how Julius Caesar was actually a good guy. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
That he wrote, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, which basically is sort of trying to rehabilitate the image of Caesar, casting him as like a Stalin figure. Because I guess Parenti is sort of a Stalin apologist.
Parenti's a soft Stalin apologist. I mean, like a lot of Maoists are. And when you meet contemporary Stalin apologists, he seems absolutely mild. But
right. Okay. So I read this in like 2004.
Right.
Back when there were the left equivalent of Frog Twitter didn't like exist yet.
Yeah,
you know.
It was in a time without parlor Stalinist.
Like, there was the SovietEmpire.com message boards.
That's true.
But that was almost exclusively like a... I mean, I guess it was really like the embryonic form of what we see on, like, you know, neo-Stalinist Twitter today. But it was really like a very, very small community. I don't know why I had anything to do with it, but I was just like a kid on the internet, you know?
In the late 90s and the aughts, if you were a Stalinist, you were likely a far rightist, actually. Like, you were...
Well, that's where we came across all the Knots Bulls.
Yeah,
right.
That's
like,
right.
I've been dealing with Knots Bulls since like 2001, arguing with them online and stuff like that. And seems like there was a lot more actual Knots Bulls than there are now. Like, there aren't like literally any. Except for that everyone gets called one now.
Right. No, I think you're right. One of the things is, like, the Juche Defense Society at the time was all right wing. Like...
The what?
Juche Defense Society in the aughts was all, like... It was all, like, neo-Nazis. It was all people who got influenced by Alexander Dugin and actual Nazbols. Back when Dugin was a Nazbol before he was the fourth positionist or whatever. And what's weird about that, though, is some of the positions don't change, like whether or not you're left or right branding. I mean, Sean Guillory recently did a podcast on Neo Maoist, and I'm reading the book by the author he interviewed, and it's amazing how nationalistic, xenophobic some of this stuff still is, even if it's dressed up in an internationalist garb. So when you read the Brumaire, none of that should surprise us, but it's really depressing. What, but even Corbynism and Sandersism seems like it has some relationship to Bonapartism in a way. Like, it's not explicitly so. I don't think most of the people who are supporting Sanders are Bonapartist, but there's a tendency to focus on executive power almost solely, in a way that actually doesn't even make sense and like in the United States, because the executive and the legislative are separated in a way they're not in parliamentary systems. So it doesn't mean the same thing. And that, I don't think that was Bonapartism, you know, but I could easily see that degenerating to it, particularly as things get more frustrated.
Well, what I would like to do, I guess, is probably just define our terms. Mm-hmm. Talk about what Bonapartism is, first of all, because it could have a myriad of interpretations. And, you know, the one that we're using is specifically the one developed. I mean, it's not a Marxist term, but Marx picks it up and uses it to describe the coup and reign of Louis Bonaparte, Napoleon's nephew, mm-hmm. after the Revolution of 1848. And that is taken to mean a sort of authoritarian strongman that rules above the classes and purports to be ruling in the interest of generally, like I would say, of the lower classes, the working class, purporting to rule in the interests of the lower classes, but is essentially just trying to harmonize things and get things back into working order so that capitalist social relations can continue.
Right.
Trotsky picked it up to talk about Stalinism, and myriad of other Marxists have used it to talk about Hitler.
Right.
And the rise of fascism.
I mean, it's the appeal to a central authority. And in American parlance, we tend to think of it as Huey Long style populism. It's really the only time we've seen it explicitly in the U.S. Although in some ways FDR has a Bonapartist tinge to it, but doesn't go all the way there. Some things also generally associated with Bonapartism is the fact that you start using the military to set instead of political functions to settle national disputes. But that's you know, not actually as important to Marx as the way it was kind of developed later, and the way liberals sometimes.
I was going to say, I think that the way that Trotsky uses it is pretty much the replacement of civilian government with military administration, but to back, you know, to basically to prop up the rule of a class that can't rule on its own behalf. So it was funny, where I was having this discussion with some friends about the class nature of the French Revolution, and we were like, well, if you look at who's actually in power, who's at the helm of state, it's not the bourgeoisie, and yet it's properly understood as a bourgeois revolution. And Bonapartism just kind of helps explain that, I think, at least in the way that it's used there. But of course, it's used a whole bunch of other ways too.
That description makes sense when talking about fascism, because fascism is an attempt to rule on behalf of the petty bourgeoisie. But the petty bourgeoisie has no doesn't have a strong enough social base from which to draw its support. So, and you know, some sort of dictatorship has to rule and in its favor. And then, of course, it makes alliances with the ruling class, and then dilutes its aims to accommodate the aims of the bourgeoisie, and et cetera.
Yeah, I've always found that a little bit too simple to explain what happens actually in Italy with fascism proper. The other reason is the petty bourgeoisie and the workers overlap is real in the sense that, like,
especially in the countryside,
right?
In Italy,
right? In Italy, because like the recruiting agrarian, like post, you know, the beginnings of what you might call an agrarian proletariat in Italy, which developed really late as opposed to like how it did in the UK in like the 16th century. It leads to the appeal of things like national syndicalism and stuff like that, which easily gets folded into and subordinated to petty bourgeois interests, but actually does have some real working class base. Like, and it's interesting to deal with if you look at like, you know, conservative politics in general, where there actually is generally real, you know, some real working class support for conservative politicians. It is in agrarian areas, even if they're not actually agrarian labor anymore. It's like post-agrarian or service sector. But like the interests are similar, and that you need a strong state and strong redistribution. But what you don't want is like truly socialist redistribution or socialization. You want a state to support your inefficient business.
Right, and that's that was what fascism was an attempt to formulate a state that would rule on behalf of inefficient businesses.
Right.
And of course, the entropy of trying to create a state that was primarily dominated by the interests of big business with a ruling party that purported to have the aims of small business necessarily ended up causing what we end up seeing as the betrayal of the fascists of the first hour, quote unquote,
right,
using square quotes here.
The light of log knives, the purging of, particularly in Nazi Germany, where the Strasserists, the real ones, not, you know, the ones on the internet, that don't exist.
You mean the ones that don't exist?
That at one time did exist. Like I used to say, I used to actually argue with them, particularly if they were English-speaking Russians behind a keyboard.
I've been led to believe that the overwhelming majority of the English-speaking left is Strasserites and Nazbols. Is that not true?
I don't know. It might be, because apparently it doesn't have anything to do with what you believe. Just it has something to do with your posting style.
Yeah.
So
you might secretly be one and not even know it.
What are the interesting things that I think, though, that I have some sympathetic to high Stalinism on, and I know you guys as former Trots are going to cringe a bit, but I think third period equation on social fascism is actually not entirely false.
Oh, you got to listen to the episode that we're about to put out. It'll probably come out tomorrow, uh-huh, day after we record this, but we just analyzed the second half of a book, The Marxists in the Face of Fascism, mm-hmm, and we talk about where those theories came from and how you can see why they occurred.
Right.
Though I totally disagree with the idea of calling social democracy social fascist, I see the logic in it.
Right.
I understand.
The short summary of the argument, I would say, is that acting as the unwitting handmaiden of fascism by clinging to bourgeois norms at a time when those norms are breaking down, rather than committing to the social revolution that you purportedly believe in or endeavor to bring about,
right,
isn't the same thing as being objectively fascistic.
I would agree.
And the reason why that distinction is important is because you can't win over masses of workers who you are calling fascists,
right,
against fascism.
I agree entirely with the caveat that the leadership of a lot of the fascist movement does legitimately come from social democrats.
That's true.
In Italy specifically.
In Italy specifically, to a lesser degree in Germany.
Strasser was actually a social democrat before he was a Strasserite.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, the right wing of the right wing, and I'm saying this in this double right way, but it's true. The right wing of the right wing of social democracy, you know, does cause Freikorps, which is where you get a whole lot of the Nazis from. But
right, that's true.
But their class base was different. So if you're looking, mm-hmm, at the intellectual tradition, it also seems like, oh, there's a real social democratic core to this. There's a, like, Schachtism, which is the early monetary theory of the Nazis, sounds a lot like Keynesianism. Like,
oh yeah,
like it's
was it you that called Nazi economic theory hyper Keynesianism?
Yeah, I did. I called it. I said Schachtism is hyper Keynesianism just to like piss people off. And weirdly, the American right actually picked up on this. I'm not talking about like what's his face, the Never Trumper who wrote the liberal fascism book that's really stupid.
But like John Flynn and the isolationist Americans who were actually fascist sympathetic were also calling all the proto-Keynesian policies fascist.
Is it Jonah Goldberg?
Yeah, Jonah Goldberg. Yeah. But I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about like John Flynn and the America First Committee. And the
right. So this would have. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that it makes a little bit of sense to call what FDR, the New Deal, corporatist. Mm-hmm. I don't necessarily know about fascist, but I think corporatism exists all over the political spectrum. And I wouldn't be completely against the characterization of the New Deal as corporatist.
Right. So it's basically a class collaborationist pact. To call it fascist proper is to mischaracterize it. But fascism is a subset of the same thing. Right.
But fascism, I mean, we've beaten this to death on this podcast, but I think it's worth doing forever because it's a zombified thing, right? That fascism has a distinct political character that makes it fascism, even if it shares 80% of its DNA with other things.
Right. And honestly, most of what we call fascist in the modern world is not technically speaking even... It's analogous with elements of fascism, but it would be like calling like Lasallianism fascism. I mean, like it's...
Yeah. We're big on trying to not do that.
Right.
Like, specifically, we're, like, parsing what is fascism and what isn't fascism. And I think that, and I say this all the fucking time, I think the key element, the number one element that makes fascism fascism, that you cannot separate from it, is the corporatism, the anti-capitalism of fascism, right? Where you can have authoritarian rightist regimes, like Pinochet was not a fascist. Pinochet was an authoritarian neoliberal, right?
Mm.
And, you know, Bolsonaro is not a fascist. Bolsonaro is another authoritarian neoliberal. And I think the reason I think that the distinction is important is because you can ape the revolutionary rhetoric and anti-capitalist rhetoric of the left to incite the working class to support you if you have that sort of anti-capitalist aim and try to offer some sort of like, you know, Keynesian solutions to neoliberal problems. And if you just bring in an authoritarian neoliberalism and keep doing neoliberalism the same way, you're going to be left with the problems that your, you know, quote unquote, fascist regime is trying to assuage, you know?
Mm-hmm. Which is, which does lead to a lot of, I mean, it's a lot of, the authoritarian rightists don't tend to last very long, frankly.
No.
Because they're trying to do.
And I think that that's why.
They're trying to do neoliberalism in fascist costume, and it doesn't work.
Right.
And but with Bonapartism is more fascinating because Bonapartism and corporatism are really related, but it's, again, it's a subspecies, but it's a much broader subspecies than fascism is.
Right.
Like,
I mean, there's also a distinction between progressive Bonapartism and the second time as farce
right
Bonapartism that Marx talks about.
Well, there's a difference between Napoleon and Louis Napoleon. So
yeah, exactly.
However, like progressive, all the seeds of the regressive character of Bonapartism is always there from the in its first instance. I mean, if you talk about like the Caudillo system, which I guess, you know, to bring it into a Spanish context, there are left and right Caudillos all the time.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
I mean, you could argue that Chavez became a, particularly because, and I'm not against Chavismo, and did, you know, real workers' council stuff, but how he ended up maintaining power was a mixture of appealing to the central form and making sure that the military stayed loyal. And that has Bonapartist characteristics, but it was pretty progressive. I mean, like...
yeah, absolutely.
But like, when you have less competent leadership doing that, i.e. Maduro, things degenerate really quickly.
Right. I mean, you could see, I'm not prepared to endorse this, but I can, I think that there's a useful discussion that could be had about the Bonapartist drift of Bolivarianism and how its ultimate culmination is, you know, the Maduro period, which is not marked by extensive mass mobilization from below in tandem with the policies of the state from above.
Right.
You have way, like the Pesuve Congress, which says, yeah, you can expropriate land if you can prove you can run it. And then you have all these people running out and doing so, and then they have it ratified. Their actions have been made legal before they do it, and it encourages them to do it. And there's this interplay between that is completely absent. Or I shouldn't say completely, but it is considerably less
diminished.
Yeah, it's not the driving force of the process as it was once, at least purported to be. And like you said, there's still this progressive element to it. Like, obviously, none of us seek the desire. None of us seek the overthrow of the Venezuelan government by any of the forces arrayed against it right now.
Especially not inept mercenaries from the United States.
But that doesn't mean that there's no, you know, you can't stall a process forever.
Right. And to survive, Maduro is economically neoliberalizing lots of the economy. I mean, like, and that's...
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, honestly, that's true. I mean, for all the defenders on, of say, like, weird defenders of, like, North Korea, one of the biggest secrets of Kim Jong-un's success is he selectively neoliberalized trade with Russia and China, which is a new policy.
Right.
Yeah, I would like to read something about that. I have seen almost nothing about that.
Russians write about it, and that's about it. So,
yeah.
But like, because I was like, where's this economic success? Because there has been economic success in North Korea in the last 3 to 5 years. And I'm like, what? Where's it from? Oh, they're trading in a block almost solely with China and Russia. But China's like, you know, the world's second largest economy. So, of course.
Yeah.
Like, they can support North Korea. Like,
right. Well, and this is where having like really clear understanding of what we mean when we say something, this is why it matters, because there are political consequences to how we conceive of these things. Mm-hmm. Like early on, you said that there is an approach to a political understanding of Xi Jinping, which is Bonapartist, or has enough of the coloring of Bonapartism to at least kick off a discussion about it. And at the same time, I think we could also say that, like, if you were elected to run China right now, how would you do it? And would it be fundamentally different than he is? And
no.
And I think that it's like the term doesn't, it's not like fascism in that it, like, you know, we were saying, it doesn't automatically carry with it like a condemnation. It's just that it's a description of a phenomenon. And then what happens out of that is an important and open question.
Well, yeah, we shouldn't conflate the normative and the descriptive. However, I will say that if you end up in a Bonapartist dilemma, usually the results are bad.
But you want to get out of it as quickly as you can.
Yes.
Even Bonaparte couldn't do it.
But I mean, like Trotsky, like you know, I don't share the extensive Trotskyist background you do, but one of the things that I always admired about Trotsky in hindsight, I mean, Trotsky realized that if he'd had to head the Soviet Union and keep the classes, the peasant and petty proprietor classes in there and not have the catastrophic results of collectivization, which Trotsky actually advocated for.
Yeah.
Right.
And like,
I think that Stalin probably enacted those, that collectivization at a much more drastic level than Trotsky conceived.
Oh, yeah. I don't want to say, like, there's love comes to say, well, you know, Stalin was just doing what Trotsky had. Stalin didn't do it the way Trotsky would have done it. But, like, it.
Yeah. But he did want
to. But he did want to do it. And honestly, Trotsky, because of this, Trotsky also, like, missaw Bukharin as his, like, he saw Bukharin as the big enemy, the big bad, not Stalin for a long time in the early period. And, yeah, that was unfortunate. But the reason why that I say I admire Trotsky's later in life is he realized, I think, from in retrospect, those debates with Bukharin, that, you know, after Bukharin died, that he would have had to have been a Bonapartist figure too. There would have been no way out of that, given the situation of development and who they had to keep in their political coalition in a state that did not have majority proletarian population when the revolution started. I mean, that's just kind of an objective fact. So,
right. The Soviet Union was engaged in a war for space as opposed to the war for time, right?
Right.
That's one of my favorite formulations. I feel like it helps make sense of so much stuff. Could we say that we have defined our terms? Is that what we did?
So, I mean, we started with Bonapartism as like the historical phenomenon that emerges when you have a crisis, usually in a bourgeois parliamentary system, and it resembles Caesarism in the fact that the crisis leads to a single person quasi-dictatorship, not always an outright dictatorship,
but definitely a strong man, like a great man kind of rule by either force of personality or dictatorship.
Right. So and what you have is a cult, a cult in Marx. He describes it as the bourgeois, you know, coalesces all this absolute authority to save itself in the executive, and then will, realizing what it's doing and the regressive orders leading to protest, will then call in a outside enemy order to suppress itself, but to keep mm-hmm. things functioning by dampening down all class conflict, which as a like a bourgeois parliament or a capitalist parliament can't do because it's acting in the interest of its of one class. That's how that emerges in the Brumaire. Like, and I know that doesn't sound clear, but it in so I mean Marx, you know, says like they realize that all this open discussion from liberalism that the bourgeois pointed out is actually leading to socialistic ideas. And so the bourgeois has to reintroduce his forms of the Ancien Regime. And then in doing that becomes massively unpopular, particularly with the peasants who supported the reactionary regime, but are now getting bilked by it. And so the peasants and the petty bourgeois need a counterforce to the big bourgeois, and weirdly, it's in the bourgeois' interest to allow this to happen. Like, mm-hmm. that's what's interesting about it. Like, it's actually in the bourgeois interest to allow what looks like a counterforce to emerge, because it can calm down the class conflicts otherwise. And it does that in a figure. But what I wonder about is that's in the DNA, like, that's in the DNA of socialist movements, like I've said, all the way back to LaSalle. So LaSalle thought, like, was a monarchical supporter because he thought that you couldn't, that the bourgeois love of, like, republicanism meant that the working class's real ally was going to be aristocratic anti-capitalist elements.
Right, like Bismarck. Yeah, Bismarck. Specifically, right?
Bismarck in specific, and you know, the Kaiserreich.
Yeah.
You know,
strange bedfellows.
Even though, you know, immediately that leads to the anti-socialist laws, but... Whoops. You know, but yeah.
I read in Left Voice that Bolsonaro is pre-Bonapartist, which helps blur any definition that you could ever put forward, I think.
But, Bonapartism, to me, the thing that makes it different from just regular old Caesarism or the need for a dictator is that there's a corporatist class character to it. Although you could say that that's true for, like, autocracies all the way back to ancient Rome. That what Caesar does is try to balance plebeian and patrician class conflict, mm-hmm. And dies for it, but ends up, you know, starting a new regime. Where that to me is interesting, but the corporatism and Bonapartism seems specifically capitalistic. Are it can't happen in, like, you don't. Like, the same game theoretical dynamics happen in non-capitalist societies, but it doesn't manifest this way.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so, like, what are some historical examples of Bonapartism?
Peronism,
the judicialism of Juan
Perón. Yeah.
Yeah, in Argentina.
Kircher version of Peronism even more so.
Yeah, Nestor Kirchner, or Kirchner, or whatever. Yeah.
I've often toyed around with, like, Bathism as a form of Bonapartism, but I'm not really sure if I'm wedded to it, but that's one that comes to mind.
Nasserism is a form of Bonapartism, I think, for sure, which would make Bathism sort of similar.
Yeah.
Right. So, yeah, I guess... Nasserism and Baathism and, you know, whatever Libyan rule was are sort of like these weird forms that straddle right and left in multiple instances, and I think could be described as Bonapartist, especially in the sense that they are like ruled by strong man that stands above the classes and harmonizes the conflict between the classes throwing some benefits to the working class, and they are essentially corporatists.
Well, and the road to power is a critical feature of this too, because like Nasser takes power in an officer's coup, Gaddafi takes power in an officer's coup. Like Assad doesn't come to power riding the wave of a, you know, a general strike and like armed insurrection of the proletariat. Correct me if I'm wrong, but basically all of these regimes come into power as a result of like a progressive movement within the army, like as if they were the Decembrists, but just in a 20th century context.
Right, which is a little different from Bonapartism in the sense that a lot of Bonapartists, even Louis Napoleon, come from crisis, not from military coups, but from crises within parliamentary systems. That's like how...
Right.
Like
he's elected and then does...
Yeah. Well, interestingly also, like Chavez's first attempt to take power is in a military coup, and then he follows the parliamentary road later. So, like, the seeds of Bonapartism are, like, kind of always there.
Right. And so one of the things that seems to always happen after Bonapartism is it seems to I'm hesitant to put it in a clear either or, but there seems to be two ways that it tends to degenerate. One, it either goes back, you've restored class balance and you go back to something like capitalism or neoliberal capitalism or something like that. Or two, your state degenerates into reactionaryism and falls apart. Like, that seems to be the two things that tend to happen.
Or one and then the
other.
That's where probably the most useful thing that Trotsky has to say about Bonapartism is that it's this description of like a ball on the point of a pyramid as like a permanently unstable thing. It's like this can't be like a new form of society. It's merely a transition toward or back some other form of society.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, because the harmony between the classes is temporary. One class will inevitably overtake the other or cause the common ruin of the two.
Right. So one of the reasons I worry about modern Bonapartism, even in like the United States, is that our definition of socialism as class power as opposed to socialism as redistributive means has changed. Mm-hmm. So we tend to think of socialism as in terms of redistribution of wealth, class appeasement, workers' representation and government, good programs that you and I would all support. Like I support Medicare for all.
Yeah.
But those are easily Bonapartist programs.
Yeah.
Like,
I mean, like, yeah, absolutely. And I think that there's a difference between like those of us who support the working class, pro-working class reforms, and those of us who see those as the end goal.
Right.
Right? Like I think that most of us on the revolutionary left that supported Bernie Sanders saw him as like a wedge to drive in the cracks, to expose contradictions and heighten, you know, some sort of class consciousness, and maybe something more interesting and better could come out of it.
To but then accelerate, there is if you will.
Yeah. Then there are, I think, probably the vast majority of the people that got involved in the DSA because of Bernie Sanders and like that ilk that wanted Bernie Sanders to get elected and, you know, use his executive power to get rid of student debt and start enacting reforms that would benefit the working class as like strongman.
Right. You know? And some people see this as a good thing. And I would say, like, yeah, I guess that I think it could be a good thing, except it would immediately introduce a political crisis. And also, Bernie Sanders wouldn't be a very good strongman.
No, he wouldn't. He's too nice to be a good strongman, I think.
But there's a postmortem by one of his staffers that floating around the internet. And what it struck me about this, you know, for all our talk of Strassism and that nonsense, it did strike me that what some of the staffers wanted was a Bonapartist figure who can come in and kick ass and take executive power and do this since, you know, the PMC are divided or whatever. And what I read this morning, and this seems to be so crucial to this. It's three paragraphs from the Brumaire that I literally discussed for 2 hours earlier today, but I think it's really important. Whatever amount of passion and declamation might be employed by the party of order, which is the party of capital, against the minority from the Tribune of the National Assembly, its speech remained as monosyllabic as that of the Christians, whose words be yea, yea, nay, nay. As monosyllabic on platform as in the press, flat as a riddle whose answer is known in advance. Whether it is a question of the right of petition, or the tax on wine, or freedom of press, or free trade, the clubs, our municipal charter, the protection of personal liberty, our regulation of the state budget, the watchword constantly recurs, the theme always remains the same, the verdict is ever ready and invariably reads socialism. Even bourgeois liberalism is declared socialistic. Bourgeois enlightenment socialistic. Bourgeois financial reform socialistic. It is socialistic to build a railway where a canal already exists. And it is socialistic to defend oneself with a cane when one is attacked with a rapier. This is not merely a figure of speech, fashion, or party tactics. The bourgeoisie has true insight into the fact that all the weapons it has forged against feudalism turned its points against itself, that all the means of education it had produced rebelled against its own civilization, that all the gods it had created had fallen away from it. It understood that the so-called bourgeois liberties and organs of progress attacked and menaced its class rule at its social foundation and its political summit simultaneously, and therefore became socialistic. In its menace, and therefore... In this menace and this attack, it rightly discerned the secret of socialism, whose import and tendency it judges more correctly than the so-called socialists know how to judge itself. The latter can accordingly not comprehend why the bourgeoisie cowardly hardens its heart against it, whether it sentimentally bewails a doctrinaire fashion in which invents a system for conciliation and the welfare of all classes. Why the bourgeoisie does not grasp, however, was the logical conclusion that its own parliamentary regime, its own political rule in general, was now also bound to meet with the general verdict of condemnation as being socialistic, as long as the rule of the bourgeois class had not been completely organized, and as long as it had not acquired its pure political expression, the antagonism of other classes likewise could not appear in its pure form. And where it did appear, could not take the dangerous turn that transformed every single struggle against state power into a struggle against capital. In every stirring of life in society, it saw tranquility imperiled, and how would it want to maintain it at the head of a regime of unrest, its own regime, the parliamentary regime, the regime that, according to the expression of one of its spokesmen, lives in struggle and by struggle, the parliamentary regime lives by discussion, how shall it forbid discussion? Every interest, every social institution has transformed into general ideas, debated as ideas, how shall any interest or institution sustain itself against the thought and impose itself as an article of faith? The struggle of the orators on the platform evokes the struggle of the scribblers of the press. The debating club in the parliament is necessarily supplanted by the debating clubs in the salons and the bistros. The representatives who constantly appeal to public opinion give public opinion the right to speak its mind in petitions. The parliamentary regime leaves everything to the discussion of majorities. How can the great majorities outside of parliament not want to decide? When you play a fiddle at the top of the state, what else is to be expected but those below to dance? And thus, by stigmatizing as socialistic what it previously extolled as liberal, the bourgeoisie confesses its own interest in the dictate that it should be delivered from the danger of its own rule.
Wow.
Yeah, and that's Marx at his best as far as like stylistically.
Yeah, I was talking about like he got into economics and then like his style just bloop. But what's interesting to me about that though is you can see this very much right now. And frankly, you don't just see it from the conservative elements in our society. The Democrats are becoming very afraid of free speech. They're becoming very afraid of bourgeois liberties. Some of it for somewhat valid reasons, but it's...
Well, it's because of Russia.
Yeah. But it's an appeal and degeneration of things like political liberty, and we've seen it before. And, you know, I was reading Matt Taibbi today. He was describing this very thing happening right now. And then immediately in the comments, you know what I see? I see, well, what you don't understand is they're all socialists. And I was like, oh, my God. This, you know, Romney Care becomes Obamacare becomes communism, you know? Like, to paraphrase my friend Esri from Swampside Chats. Like, and socialists get blamed for bourgeois rule.
Yeah.
And then to appeal weirdly to one of the other things about this is this appeal to the working class and to these other classes, often led by a petty bourgeoisie, is also weirdly, even though it's enacting socialistic programs, and I would say socialistic because they're not truly socialist, but and nationalizing things and this, that, and the other, that they're doing it in the name of anti-socialism, which again you see it in both the neoconservatives, who are broadly neoliberal but still did this, and in the Trumpists, who are something else, but they both have done this thing.
The Trumpists, who are crypto-neoliberal.
Yeah. You might call them, like,
post-neoliberal or crypto-neoliberal. Like, they talk nationalist talk, but they know if they really tried to do autarky, both their economy would fall apart and also there would be immediate war. So,
yeah.
But it still sounds nice.
Yeah, it does.
It's still a thing that they like to desire to happen, even if they're not going to do it. Which is why they're not real Bonapartists or real fascists.
Or even real paleo-conservatives. Yeah,
they're just... I mean, they're reactionaries.
Just fucking neoliberals. Yeah. Everybody is just neoliberal. That's the thing.
Yeah. Hey, everybody. Chris here. Just wanted to remind you guys of a couple of things. First of all, we have a Patreon. And if you like listening to us and think we deserve $2 a month of your hard-earned money, please go and sign up. Right now, our patrons get access to irregularly posted content that includes special episodes, where we do deep dives into stuff that might be too nerdy for our main feed, extra content from episodes that go way longer than we expected, and impromptu discussions of events and articles that we think are worth a bit of attention. The second thing I wanted to remind everyone of is that we are now part of the Lost Horizons Network, which is a dialectical pessimist podcasting network that includes us, The Regrettable Century, Red Library, and From 78. You can listen to us, Red Library, and From 78 using your favorite podcatching app, or find us by searching our respective names on Twitter and Facebook. We also have a special Lost Horizons Network collaboration podcast, which is a roundtable discussion including members of all three podcasts. Our network website can be found at LostHorizonsNetwork.com, which will be linked in the show notes. Our roundtable discussions will be available to listen on your favorite podcatching app, and also look out for us on social media. Just search for the Lost Horizons Network. And as always, please remember to subscribe, rate, and review us on iTunes. Those ratings and reviews help trick the algorithm into thinking that we're important and have something interesting to say. All right, back to the show.
So that was Varn during his late Debordian phase.
Yeah.
He skipped the good part and he just adopted the bad part.
Luckily you came back from that.
Yeah, I mean, but one of the reasons I'm passionate about Bonapartism is actually my paleo conservatism came from these frustrations. Like, if like personally, yeah. Like I got super frustrated with the left not being able to do anything. I got frustrated there being no workers' organs, and I just wanted it ameliorated immediately. And I was tired of these damn liberals not doing any damn thing, and like not even delivering on promises that they made 2 weeks ago and even done a few years back. Like, you know, and I didn't understand the way class antagonism was working. I didn't really get that the Democrats were also a capitalist party. And, you know, and so the element, like when I say Bernieism and Corbynism have some elements of Bonapartism, it's not the strongmanness, it's the corporatism. But by corporatism, I know every dumbass liberal thinks when we say corporatism, we mean the rule of corporations. No, what we mean is the incorporation of all classes into a single unit.
Right. Yeah. Not electing Wells Fargo president, which is essentially what we have now. But I think that draw is something that we're coming out of the end of a peak. Well, I mean, the other side of a peak in that sort of thing happening again with the beginning of Trumpism. Because I know several people that got taken in by Trump as a person who would break the system. And even though he was using, you know, abominable rhetoric, was talking about how we should stop bombing other countries, get out of Iraq and Afghanistan, Syria, and talking about cleaning out Washington.
Well,
and that sounded really good to a lot of people who aren't like politically sophisticated and who also don't share the hyper sort of inflated fears of fascism that the liberal left did in the lead up to the Trump election.
Well, they also like at least vaguely hinted at, you know, federal subsidies for failing industries that whole towns rely on, like, you know, coal plants and whatever. And the only thing liberals had to say about it was just get a different job. Right. So, like, I see the appeal
liberals
for
said,
sure.
America is already great, right? While, you know, it's worse than it's been since the Great Depression.
Yeah, that's
that's, you know, they liberals had this Whiggish view of history that, you know, they were all secretly Steven Pinkerites, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, oh, we just had Obama. Everything's getting better. And like, you know, under Obama, you saw, and this is not Obama's fault per se, but you saw the greatest loss of black wealth since like the 50s. Like, it was... Yeah. It was something that people just couldn't deal with, and even the people experiencing couldn't deal with it. And a lot of there was even some, like, when I talk about Obamaism as sort of like liberal soft Bonapartism, there is a truth to that, that people were appealing to him as a way to like, we can do this together. Let's collaborate. We don't need antagonism anymore. Of course that immediately failed, and it fails from, you know, I made a joke that was based on this in 2015, when I was in Egypt, and I said, look, you know, a failed Obama mania can lead to, you know, to a rapid Trumptopia. And everybody thought I was being nuts, but it was based off of this thought process here. Like, we invested so much into this progressive form of executive power, which isn't truly Bonapartism, but it is adjacent to it. And that didn't get us anywhere. Well, what's going to happen next? And when you ask like working class people who vote, and again, most of them don't, if they did vote for Trump, a lot of them also did vote for Obama.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
And a lot of them wanted to vote for Sanders.
Right. But
always for the same reason in every case.
Yeah, so, I mean, there is a certain amount of political nihilism, but it's a frustration that their class interests aren't being addressed and things are super suppressive. And this COVID stuff is going to make this even more relevant. And
right, yeah.
Like, because we don't have a strong... Like, we didn't... One of my criticisms of the Sanders campaign that I still stand by, that I had the entire time, even when I was a Sanders supporter, was that you weren't really looking at the institutions of working class organization in a new enough way. Like, we weren't creating parapolitical orgs. Base building was still pretty much based on traditional union organizing, business unions, etc. And I'm not saying that was bad, but like, that expanded very slowly, very sporadically, and it's very limited in what it can do in the United States. And so new forms of organization didn't emerge as a counterpower. And so I was afraid that like, well, what's going to happen when Sanders gets in and he's not a Bonapartist figure? He can't deliver anything. He gets like the courts are already set against him, and he's not going to have like, Sanders isn't going to have military support. He doesn't think that way. So like, what's going to happen? He's going to be lame duck president at best. And at worst, you know, you have your first U.S. coup.
Right. I mean, the hope that a lot of people had, or the expectation or the desire that was being expressed, was that Sanders would be kept in check by, you know, the movement or whatever, like a countervailing power at the level of the streets. And obviously, sure, I would like to see that. But I have often wondered why we thought that that was the thing that would happen, or why people thought that was the thing that would happen. Like, maybe a strike wave would be precipitated by a Sanders as president at the beginning of the economic crisis that we're now blaming on the coronavirus. But that permanent mobilization is, I think, predicated on a popular understanding of the presidency that doesn't actually exist.
Right.
Like, not in the way that, like, when they try to overthrow Chavez and 2 million people come out to defend the president. That's not like there isn't a one-to-one analogy that can be drawn from that experience in Venezuela and whatever we think the American people would do when Sanders was faced with obstruction in Congress.
And, you know, you're not, as things degenerate, I don't know where a lot of people are going to go. Like, for all the fear of right wing, you know, of Trumpism and all that, I have said for a long time that, like, that's not what I'm afraid of. And I'm not afraid of the alt-right. What I'm afraid of is what's going to come next. And,
right,
and like, I think all this just got accelerated, like, greatly. Yeah. Like,
right. I've been saying for a long time that I think that all Trump really did was set the precedent for someone who's actually competent and charismatic, or I mean, Trump is charismatic, but someone who's actually competent as well as charismatic to come in and push forward, you know, a neoliberal agenda that just doesn't seem as bad because it's not as vulgar.
Right.
You know, like someone like Tom Cotton or Josh Hawley. Or hell,
someone like Andrew Cuomo. It doesn't even have to be a Republican.
Yeah, I was going to say,
there we go. Yeah.
There are plenty of liberal figures that are equally terrifying. Look, like I say all this as a person who, like, I didn't just want Sanders to win. Like, I actively campaigned and like, went knocking door to door, like, without illusions, but still, like, I don't know what'll happen out of this, but I want to see.
Right? I put a D in front of my name to vote in a primary, which I'd never done in my life. So
I've only done it twice, yeah. And both times it was for Bernie Sanders. So, like, I was as much a part of the Sanders campaign as the average person could be. But we all talked, you know, privately, like, what the fuck are we going to do if we win?
Yeah, I mean...
Of course, we didn't get a chance to see it, and the world that's unfolding, I agree with you, is much more terrifying than the fever dreams of liberals who think that we're on the precipice of the Fourth Reich.
You remember what I said about it, and I think that pretty much everyone disagreed with me, but what I said was I think that the best possible scenario would be to see Sanders get elected and then like flayed alive by the Democratic Party and, you know, completely neutered and have just such anger at what happened to him by his own party that maybe there would be a, you know, a move out in a direction towards something else. But I thought that was like the best case scenario because I didn't think that Sanders would be able to actually do anything in power.
Well, I allowed myself to start to get swept up in it, I'll admit.
I had hopes for maybe a reform to Obamacare that was Medicare for all light. And then what you're talking about, Chris, that was the best case scenario for me too.
Or maybe like a universal forgiveness of student loans because the entire economy collapsed and they're desperate for anything that would try to help while Sanders was president, maybe. But, you know.
I mean.
Because he would have that power, that executive power. He wouldn't need to push it through Congress.
And you know, I've actually been thinking about this, like how we should feel about like Biden and Trump. Like we obviously, like the Supreme Court stuff makes this a much more gamey proposition. But let's be honest for a second.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's say Biden wins and becomes a 4-year Democratic president, because in this context, I cannot imagine him being competent enough to, like, steer things around.
Oh, no.
And, you know, having the Jimmy Carter effect. What comes after that? What is the Reaganism to Trump's Nixonism if Nixon's also Reagan? Like, that... You're talking about first as second, you know, first as tragedy, then as farce. Well, like, what is hyper farce? Like what does that even mean? Like
travesty. Third is travesty. Yeah. Right.
Travesty. Well, tragicomedy. Like apocalypse. You
know, annihilation. Yeah. There we go.
We always talk about left unity because we think of the Second International, but we don't think about the first one. The First International is when the Union started coalescing into pan-union movements, which became non-parliamentary parties, which became parliamentary parties. Before that, parties were just factions of parliamentary legislatures that were decided amongst themselves, or in the United States, they were mass voter-based organs, but they were not class organs. Or they were class organs, but for one class. We don't have anything like that, so we're trying to skip that step. And to be fair, I know why we are, because like industrial union model doesn't really work in the modern economy, and the divisions within the working class, if you read someone like Eric Olin Wright on this, actually do create real tensions that make mass class organizing really hard. And I'm not just talking about racial and gender divisions either. I'm talking about sector divisions. I'm talking about domination. I'm talking about cultural capital mongering within the working class itself, limitations of opportunity, regionalism that's because of limitations of opportunity. Like, that all plays in, and it's part of why the working class sits on its hands, is it really doesn't, they cannot have a stake, and it is divided amongst itself. In that environment, Bonapartism makes a lot of sense. And I think what people, when they talk about professional managerial class stuff, and like I've talked to people about it, I get the man, I actually buy the managerial class thesis and the professional creative class thesis, but jamming them together makes no sense. Like the creative mm-hmm. class is like a substrate of kind of petty bourgeois kind of workers somewhere in the middle.
Right.
But the managers are, yeah, they're technically wage earners, but like their interests are solely bourgeois. They don't have the same interest at all. And so talking about PMC is very confusing. It's, it conflates the two.
There is, and you and I talked about this the other day, Derek, there's a need to constantly try to reevaluate what we mean when we say things. And I think that like the idea of a professional managerial class holds some merit, but it is being defined much too sharply because it's not that it's amorphous. Yeah. And it bleeds into the petty bourgeoisie and it bleeds into the proletariat on either end of it. So to talk about the PMC as though it's a class with its own specific interests is it's incorrect. It's not sharp. But the divisions aren't sharp.
Right. Enough. If anything, PMC is used as a sort of description of affectation or aesthetic,
or really education
ceases. Yeah, and it ceases to describe any real phenomenon other than like a cultural veneer over contradictory phenomenon in the sense of social classes, anyways.
Right.
This is why I initially rejected the idea of the professional managerial class when I first read about it from Michael Albert. You know,
well, it's why I still kind of do, even though I also accept it as a part of today's parlance when describing what I think is more about the hegemony of bourgeois modes of thinking across multiple class layers. So that there's so little like conscious subjectivity on the part of like working class people, especially in like white collar jobs, that they identify more wholly with bourgeois norms than they should and that they have historically. And so it's kind of like labor aristocracy is only useful if you don't take it too far, and then it starts to become a way of misunderstanding, if that makes sense. Like it can in the first instance it can explain a certain element of something, and then after a while, if you use it too much, it starts to change your definition of what a class actually is.
Right, it really does.
See, what it accurately describes a muddling of ideology that applies to a certain layer of people. It doesn't have a class basis in anything different than the petty bourgeoisie or the working class. So it's purely ideological. It's not materialist at all. It's
well, I mean, the materialist basis that like Ehrenreich tries to give it is that we all have college debt and that college capital is actually some kind of quasi capital. But then by that, if you take the true like hard proletarian stance on that, you would lead to like the Maoist or worldist thesis or something, because like 60% of the population is educated, including the working class. Like,
right.
Right. I mean, I'm like pretty educated. You know, I've got degrees, I've got graduate education, and I am one of the most precarious people you will ever meet.
Right. So
most of my proletarian friends have better jobs and more money than I do.
But most people's definitions of classes tend to fall down because they're conflating the primary class structure of capitalism from it, which is an exploitation and ownership issue, with issues of domination and cultural capital, which can range within classes. Inter-class divisions, which is why Eric Owen Wright is much better on this than the PMC stuff, because it explains why those stratas of different classes would be co-aligned, like why you hate your boss more than your owner, how bank loans and diffusion of capital and retirement can really screw you up, why there does seem to be some truth to generational politics because I mean, let's be face it, boomers are the richest generation the world has ever seen.
The softest, richest, most privileged generation in the history of the world. And they think that they're fucking tough because some of their friends died in Vietnam. It's really funny.
And it's true in like every country too.
Yeah.
Like, every single country's
Well, maybe not every country. I think probably the Vietnamese boomers aren't.
You know. Okay, the Vietnamese boomers are actually tough.
Well, the Korean boomers are kind of tough too, actually. But like, but still, it's a similar dynamic in all these countries. And it's similar. They've had a similar tendency from progressivism to conservatism in all these countries too. I mean, like, you had the people who overthrew the Pak regime in South Korea bring the daughter of that dictator into power in 2000 and
oh yeah,
what was it, 13, yeah. So
yeah, well,
so Bonapartism.
Yeah, and yeah. So I mean, like, when I bring this up, I'm like, I see these Bonaparte adjacent tendencies all over left and right now. I don't think the left is going to get to deliver our progressive form of Bonapartism, just like we've lost the populist debate. And I actually am not, you know, I am much more cynical on us being able to use left populism effectively anyway. Like, I tend to think it's dangerous.
Well, so I didn't used to be, because for a while it was what we had, right? So there was a good, like, I don't know, decade where around the world, the revival of socialistic, in the broadest way you could understand the word, socialistic ideas were being kind of catapulted into the world in this kind of vague left populism everywhere.
Like the pink tide.
Yeah. So like, yeah. If you look, you know, whether it was the something amorphous, like the various electoral formations that have sprung up around Jean-Luc Mélenchon, or something even much more concrete like Syriza in Greece, or the whole pink tide in Latin America, or wherever it was like left populism appeared to be the initial stages of a rebirth of socialism. And at its height, you even had like Hugo Chavez saying, what if we had a fifth international of like workers' parties? And regardless of all the problems, like that wasn't a conceivable phenomenon prior. But what we've seen is left populism just across the board crash on the rocks. Like in every single case, in every continent, just nothing but failure. Despite initial successes in terms of like immediate, you know, gains on the material gains on the part of like easing the suffering of working people, left populism as a series of semi-coherent projects at this stage is a spent force. And, it appears to be
right. And one of the things about it that you have to look at, it had the same problems that Marx is describing the bourgeois factions did in France. Is for example, Lula had a chance to really reform a lot of the laws in a way that could have gotten him out of some of the problems he got into that Bolsonaro was able to use to really coup him. But he didn't.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't. He actually continued a lot of the old forms. It led to Rousseff. I'm sure that some of the corruption charges are probably legitimate because that's how Brazilian politics works. So...
I've listened to enough Glenn Greenwald to figure out that every layer of Brazilian politics is completely corrupt. Right.
I mean, and so, like, that leads us into, like, an area where, of course, it was going to go this way in some ways. But it's also, like, it could have gone another way. I don't want to make it sound like it was the only way it could have gone. But I was not, at the time, you can go back and listen to the original Pop the Left. I was actually more cynical about that stuff than I am now. Because I was afraid of how it would degenerate. And because it reminded me so much of the same wave that happened in the 60s and 70s. That led to, right, like, all these hard right coups. And I mean, I've read Naomi Klein's book and was like, oh, this tends to go in a bad way. I mean, Klein is interesting. If you read Disaster... What's that book?
It's the shock doctrine,
yeah. Where, like, she describes how social democrats tend to actually neoliberalize better than right-wing cagiolos does, but then, like, says that we just need more social democracy. Yeah. But also, like...
Right, I remember reading that book. Like, I bought it from the ISO, like, the Haymarket table, and then reading it and going, like, wait a minute, this is, like, counter to everything that the ISO says.
But, right.
You know. She's got name recognition.
I was going to say, it's a... The publishing house has its own material interests.
Right. I mean, like, the ISO, the Haymarket publishes Rebecca Solnit, too. But
yeah.
But to bring it even more
Much love for Haymarket, though.
They also published the Historical Materialism series, which is the only reason we have some decent marks of scholarship in English.
That's right.
Them and MR, that's it. So to look at this, though, from an objective standpoint, like, we had a chance for, like, maybe something like progressive Bonapartism, but we don't really... That horizon, to me, is closing.
Yeah.
But I think people I think, weirdly, that horizon closing is going to make it more attractive. And it's why you see, like... I think that's why you see the reemergence of, like, weird fetishizations for, like, high Stalinism and stuff. Like, you know, some of it's just differentiation from the DSA and troll culture, but I don't think it's all of them.
I think our horizons, with every failure, like, our expectations are lowered, and we romanticize more and more degenerated forms of what it was that we really wanted. So, you know, at first we romanticized the Soviet Union, and then it was, you know, Cuba in the 60s and 70s, and now we're romanticizing Gaddafi and Hugo Chavez, and what are we going to be romanticizing next?
Then war communism, like...
Well, here at the Regrettable Century, we are presently involved in romanticizing war communism.
That's one of our projects. I mean,
even communization theorists actually kind of romanticize war communism, but it's...
I mean, we could all use a little bit of war communism right now.
Well, I mean, what we could use is an approach to the objective conditions of the rule of capital, which is a period of unmitigated disaster after disaster after disaster. And so if our communism is going to be a 21st century one, it's going to be shaped by the experience of successive disasters. So communism is probably a better term than war communism. But functionally, it's the hybrid, warped and distorted version of what we want to see based on just how overripe the conditions are in terms of the development of the means of production, right?
Yeah. Like,
had we been able to seize power our last really good window was, like, let's say the 1970s. Had we been able to do that, we might have had a different experience to our initial stages of social transformation.
But
as it stands, it's disaster communism all the way.
I sometimes think that the bad guys lost in 1919 and we have to reimagine everything beyond that. The bad guys won in 1919, excuse me.
Oh, I was going to say, shit.
Not the bad guys lost. I mean, the bad guys lost in 1917 in Russia, but that's not where it needed to happen.
Right, they won everywhere else. Well, look, loss, just like victory, is a process.
Right. To me, 1919 is. I actually think there's still interesting stuff going on beyond that. But it's like one of those things where I even take like a Hyperlin and a Slyvorniga, and like take him seriously when he's like fighting against factionalization in the post 1921 compromise. And like, you know, I know everybody loves Gramsci, but he didn't fight that hard enough.
I mean, we love Gramsci for other reasons.
Right. But when I really look at a lot of this stuff, I also, like, there's a part of me that goes full Lefkom Frankfurt School, where I'm just like, oh, we're just in such a degenerated state, because I'm reading objective conditions from France in 1850, in 1849, and thinking, this rhymes more with what's happening right now than even stuff from the 20s or the 60s. Yeah. Like... it's really distressing. Like, you know, if I changed a few words about fighting feudalism in that paragraph I read, doesn't that sound like it would go like now? Like,
oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Just talk about, you know, what the Blairites had learned about defeating old labor, like.
So, okay. I think we're starting to
degenerate.
We're starting to reach the end of our coherence. So let's get some final thoughts out. Like, what do we think that the current sort of ideological affinity for a left Bonapartism means? Because there isn't we don't have the material conditions on the ground for anything like that to actually happen. So. People are, like I mentioned, previously, people are romanticizing sort of left Bonapartism in a time where the window has closed for even such a thing to be able to exist. What does that mean for us moving forward?
I think from my standpoint, we are at the same kind of point that, say, the Frankfurt School was in 1930 or the analytic Marxists were, groups that became very heterodox and I don't love, but who asked some primary questions and tried to reopen up things in a new way. Because if we are stuck in our old modes of dealing with this, it's a repetition compulsion. Like, you just do the same thing over and over again. Unfortunately, however, usually the new ways tend to also be, they tend to be highly influenced by whatever the current landscape is. In analytical Marxism, they take all these, you know, 70s bourgeois constructions for granted as almost, you know, de facto truths. And Frankfurt School, you have like hyper Freudian pessimism in a way that's not particularly dialectical, even though they're like the dialecticians par excellence, but not on that. So we have to somehow like go back to basics and also push forward radically. And that's really hard to do. Like, it's really hard to do both things. Like, to say, let's go back to basic class analysis and let's go back and look at like what Marx was describing in, say, 1848, 1850, 1860. And then say, like, what's the difference in conditions now and what's the same? And what can't we do because technology sufficiently changed, because of differences in political organizations, because we're fighting a bourgeois state, not a quasi-feudal one? Like, what does that mean for us now? Because also our models, like the USSR and CCP model is not possible anymore because there really isn't any major imperial backwaters left. Where are you gonna have a coalition with peasants? Like, even in India, the peasant class isn't the majority class. Like,
no, I think that the percentage of the American workforce that is involved in fishing, farming, and forestry is less than 1%, and none of those people are peasants. They're just agricultural laborers. I mean, there are like a few thousand family farms. Economically insignificant, right?
Yeah, I agree, Derek, that we've got to start over from the beginning and see what we think we can salvage from the Marxist tradition, from the many Marxist traditions.
Yeah, Marxism's plural.
from all of the Marxisms.
I was going to say, from the experience of Marxism rather than the tradition of Marxism.
Yeah, there we go. That's better. Because we are sitting on top of a pile of rubble. You know, the detritus of past generations' attempts at building something. And we've got to shift through it and try to cobble something together. And it's a daunting task because we are now at probably the most atomized we have been since before proletarianization, which I think is another part where that Marx's analysis comes in handy, where he talks about the peasantry as a sack of potatoes, right? Where they're all in the sack together, but they're all separate because they're all separate potatoes in a sack. They're not like a unified congealed mass, right?
There's no amalgamated potato form. Right.
And that is essentially due to the nature of we don't live in neighborhoods really anymore where we know our neighbors. We live in isolated pods and we work from home. We work gig economy jobs. A lot of people do. Of course, there is still a substrata of the American working class that is still proletarianized and still united. But at the same time, their representation in unions is totally insignificant.
Yeah.
Right.
So we're at a point in history where we're something like that, those potatoes in a sack, you know, but as proletarians.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
And that is something unprecedented, you know. How do we deal with that?
We're what Debord called being isolated together.
Exactly.
I mean, the idea that one of the things that bugs me, this is when I get into my foundational questions of Marxism that make me wonder about maybe something Marx didn't see, is when you read Kautsky and you read Marx, there's a certain amount of social isolation that they don't really see as possible in the proletariat and not in the working class at large. And, you know, Marx, the proletariat is roughly the same thing as the working class, but it's not exactly the same thing.
Right. It's a working class that has awoken to its potential.
Yeah, right? Working class is awoken to its potential through losing its interest in property because it has none.
Right.
We
definitely don't really have that.
Right. And so
we're all temporarily embarrassed millionaires here.
But the thing is, we always think that about America, but that's actually true for like most of the world. Like,
yeah,
like the idea that it's just Americans suffering from this problem, is because in America, because we're like the hegemony of capital, and like we're now with the core, kind of resides, although it's increasingly residing in China, which is interesting. We don't like we are where this stuff is most obvious and most dysfunctional. Kind of like in the late British Empire, it was obvious how dysfunctional it was. But
oh yeah, we're on the rapid decline as far as our global importance is concerned.
Right,
right.
But the weird thing is, so is everybody. Like, if you look at something like China's economic capacity, for example, it's been declining for 10 years. Like,
yeah, which is why it's grasping outward to try to, you know, revitalize itself through like the Belt and Road Initiative and you know, it's
right.
It's stuff like that.
I mean, that might it might end up working, but it might not.
I think one of the things is that labor tensions in China are actually getting really high because automation's really happening there too.
Yeah.
Well, you were talking about Kim Jong-un earlier, right? Mm-hmm. And one of his sort of signature policy benchmarks now is to achieve a majority automation in industrial production. Like, that's the future that everyone recognizes.
Right.
Because we still live in a society dominated by classes, like, we all recognize that, I think, rightly, as a terrifying future.
Right. Well, yeah.
Like,
what power do you have as a worker if you can't stop production? Like,
oh, you have none, right? Like, none at all. And so, I've said this before, but like, you know, when we talk about the UBI as like the policy wonks' vision of the future, to me, it doesn't sound anything like what people hope it is. It sounds more like what Jack London was writing about in The Iron Heel. It's like it's a way of creating a surplus population with literally no social power, that you can just holocaust them anytime you need to.